Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Famed movie critic Roger Ebert said that this 80s flick was the best movie about love that he'd seen in a long time. His original review stated, "Maybe that's because it's not about love as a Hollywood concept, but about love as growth, as learning to accept other people for who and what they are. There's romance in this movie, but what makes the film so special is that the romance and everything else is presented within the context of its characters, finding out who they are, what they stand for, and what they will not stand for. So get ready to be swept off your feet and let love lift us up where we belong as Ron West and I discuss An Officer and a Gentleman from 1982 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast."
Zach Mayo had no business defying the odds, let alone beating them.
You ready to quit now, Mayo? Yes!
Gotta program yourself. You'll make it.
How did you slip into this program?
You kick me out of here, then I ain't quit.
You quit.
But first, you got to get past me.
Understand?
Don't you understand? I love you.
Richard Gere, Deborah Winger, An Officer and a Gentleman, rated R.
Hello, movie viewers and movie lovers. My name is Tim Williams, the creator and host of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. On each episode, I'm joined by an 80s flick loving guest co-host to talk about one of the great and sometimes not so great movies from the 1980s. From blockbusters to cult classics to lesser known treasures we discovered on cable TV or the now defunct video rental stores from our childhood. No matter which 80s flick we choose for each episode, we have a lot of fun sharing first-time watch memories, discussing our favorite iconic scenes, and even learning some behind-the-scenes stories about the cast and crew along the way. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe and follow 80s Flick Flashback on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. And while you're there, leave us a stellar written review and a 5-star rating. You can also support the show by following us on our social media pages. Just search for 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And don't forget to check out our website, 80sflickflashback.com, as well. If you want to take your support to the next level, you can become a financial partner for less than $10 a month. The link to financially support the podcast is located in our episode show notes. And while you're there, be sure to check out more fun facts and behind-the-scenes trivia we just weren't able to fit into today's episode. Thanks for listening. Now, on with the show. I'm about to start laughing. That's going so hard because I saw your reaction. I was like, what a way to have a Valentine's Day episode with two guys talking about a romantic movie.
That's all right. We're going to do it. One another.
There you go. We're going to do it. All right. Welcome in, everybody. So glad to have you on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. As I always say, we've got a good one for you this time. And we're being truthful about this. This is a really good movie that Ron and I both enjoy. And as we'll get talking about it. But of course, I got my best friend, Mr. Ron West, on the podcast. Welcome back, my friend. How you doing?
I am doing well, Tim. Always a pleasure to be on the podcast with you, reminisce from our old podcasting days to now, and always good to see and chat with my best friend.
Yeah, from Marvel movies to An Officer and a Gentleman, we've come a long way, my friend.
we have still dealing with the superheroes.
We are right.
The superhero of Richard Gere.
There you go. Yeah, he's got nowhere else to go. He's got nowhere else to go.
Oh, that's such a great scene.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's jump right in. When did you see An Officer and a Gentleman for the very first time?
Oh, I saw An Officer and a Gentleman. It was 1982 was the year, so I was 10 years old. I saw it, as you know, most of my movie-going experience at a Bluefield, West Virginia movie theater. And I remember this because I was 10, which means my two older sisters were 15 and 16, and they were in love with Richard Gere. And so I got dragged to see this love movie that I had no interest in, but really liked the movie. Military training and sequences and everything was really good. I remember even liking it then, and then renting it, you know, when the VCR craze and everything, you know, would come, renting it, watching it, and have watched it many times since then. Although I will be honest, I think the every time I've seen it since then, I completely forgot about the opening. With him and the dad, which explains so much about who he is. Mm-hmm. That 2 minute opening, I don't remember seeing it. I'm sure I did. Watching it again, I was just like, oh,
right,
so creepy.
it is kind of an interesting way to start the movie. I guess we're jumping right in already, but it's not what I expected. And I'll say, like, I thought that I had not seen this movie, but as I was watching it, I have seen it. I did not see it when I was a kid. I think my parents saw it and did not want me to see it for, you know, obvious reasons as a young kid. My dad being in the military, I think they liked it, but the subject matter was definitely more than, you know, I needed to see it at my age, because I'm a few years younger than you. So I was definitely younger than 10 when this came out. But I think I saw it in college. Thanks to Pretty Woman, he was a sex symbol and leading man again in the 90s. So I was becoming a fan of his movies in the 90s. I was like, I need to go back and watch some of his earlier movies. And I remember An Officer and a Gentleman. Everybody's seen the ending. It's, you know, been parodied many times. So I remember watching it in college, and I think I liked it, but it wasn't what I expected. And I think because I expected it to be this more like romance type, you know, much more of a romantic movie. Not so much about the drama and the military, you know, him trying to become a soldier or become an officer. So I think I liked it, but it didn't sit with me the same way that I think watching it now did, being older and kind of under, you know, there's a lot of layers, a lot of stories and a lot of layers to the movie that you kind of have to be mature enough to really understand. So how long had it been since you watched it before watching it for the podcast?
Watching it without that opening, maybe when they show it on TV, maybe they don't show that opening. They
probably edit out a good bit of the very beginning with his dad's in the bed with his girlfriend.
And him, I mean, clearly he was having an orgy with his dad and two women.
Right.
I mean, that's saying a lot about, you know, their relationship and how things are going on. It's very awkward. So yeah, that wouldn't be on ABC movie night. They wouldn't have that opening. So other than that scene, it's probably been about 3 years since I last saw the movie. It's one of those movies really that just sucks me in anytime that it's on. It's Louis Gossett Jr. performance, Richard Gere's performance. It just pulls you in. And even every time I watch that movie, I'm rooting for him so much in the obstacle course scene. Yeah. It's like, go, set that record. Come on.
Right.
You know, and even though I know, you know, how that's going to play out, but I just get pulled in. I just wonderful movie. What about you? I know you said you'd seen it in college. Had you seen it more recently?
No. And it's not one that I think really comes on TV that much anymore. I was trying to think of, like, have I seen it on even like one of the like cable channels? Like, you know, it's funny because I guess 82, I mean, it's 40, you know, over 40 years old now. So it might be a little harder to find. Like, they're probably going to play more of his 90s. I've seen Pretty Woman, Runaway Bride, you know, some of the 90s movies that he was a part of a little bit more frequently than this one for sure.
I know Pretty Woman is on TV somewhere right now. We can turn the TV on right now. Pretty Woman is on. It's always on.
Yeah. Freeform or VH1 or one of those channels, it's probably playing. So looking at it, it didn't feel dated. Like, even watching it now, there's only a few scenes where it feels like an 80s movie, because, you know, especially the training and stuff, like a lot of that stuff probably hasn't changed that much, a little bit of the technology, I'm sure, but it really holds up really well as far as like subject matter. I think maybe a few things the gunnery sergeant can't, certain terms he probably can't say anymore that he said to them. And
Yeah, I was. There's probably a little bit more of a political correctness
right
there to it, and I'm not sure what the if it's as simple for someone to get into that program and then because basically he was just joining for the 6 years to become trying to become a pilot and then
right
and then go fly commercial planes and make a lot of money. I'm not sure it's still set up that way, but the training sequences though, the and of course we talked about the obstacle course, which is more physical fitness, but the flipping upside down in the water and having to, free yourself and not panic and hold your air. I remember as a kid watching that and just being amazed that they were, that was real, that was something that was, I mean, that was, you know, they were at the training facility. That was how they do those things. And
that one in the oxygen chamber where they take the oxygen out, they have to do simple tasks and stay focused. Like that was pretty intense too.
Yeah. Well, and that's where the one guy ends up out of the program, but that was also interesting. I'm not sure that one as a kid hit me as much as an adult. That one hits me a little bit more because you're just like, oh, whatever. You can't breathe. You can't step your hands together. You don't realize how difficult it is to stop breathing.
Right.
And still do those things. But yeah, the training sequences. And I would imagine that's the budget. I know we're not at the point we're talking about the budget, but super low budget, but the budget was getting access to those facilities and paying for them. Because there's not much else that you're really spending money for in this movie.
Yeah, there was a lot about filming locations. So it filmed in a lot of different places. It wasn't just one place. And we'll kind of get into that pre-production and shooting. But the oxygen chamber thing was actually built for the movie. Like that was not something that they were able to use. So they built it and it's actually, I think they said it's still built, like wherever they built it, it's still there today and it's used for the things now. But I think like the pool was actually at a school, like that wasn't, so they were not on a naval base, but we'll jump into that in a second. So let's jump into story origin and pre-production. But first let's talk about what does an officer or gentleman actually mean? The title of the film actually derives from the United Kingdom's Royal Navy as recorded in an 1813 court-martial against Colonel Sir J. Emer, quote, for behaving in a scandalous, infamous manner, such as unbecoming the character of an officer and a gentleman, end quote. Over time, the phrase has been more commonly shortened to conduct unbecoming. Generally speaking, this means offenses that do not match the ideals that the Navy has for its officers, even if these would not typically be prosecuted by the civilian authorities. In the film, Mayo's unbecoming conduct is his continued fixation with his civilian relationship at the expense of his naval training. So adds a new little element to that title.
Absolutely.
You know, it's very romanticized, you know, as the poster and all that kind of stuff, an officer and a gentleman, but to know it came from an actual court martial is pretty interesting. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So the script actually languished around Hollywood for about 8 years with no studio willing to finance it. Finally, at Paramount Pictures, former executive and then Disney CEO Michael Eisner was very much against the film, but relented after much persuasion by producer Don Simpson. The final budget was only a mere $6 million, part of it due to the Navy's refusal to support the production and the skepticism of the studio on whether it would be a commercial success. So it was actually shot on the Olympic Peninsula of Washington at Port Townsend at Fort Worden. The U.S. Navy did not permit filming at NAS Pensacola in the Florida Panhandle, the site of the actual aviation officer candidate school. Deactivated U.S. Army base Fort Worden stood in for the location of the school, an actual naval air station in the Puget Sound area, NAS Whidbey Island. So they still filmed in like Washington around Seattle, but it was an Army base, not a Navy base.
Interesting. I wonder why Pensacola would not allow film, because they reference in this after passing, they're going to Pensacola.
So the Navy actually refused to cooperate on the movie, saying that it portrayed their training school life in a negative and unrealistic way. Brent kindly wrote in this update, I attended AOCS in Pensacola in 1975, and true enough, there are some liberties with accuracy in the film. The DOR part is generally true. No one DORs late in the program prior to being commissioned. However, there were those seeking to ensign bars. I'm sorry, seeking the ensign bars with no interest in flying. They quit aviation immediately after becoming an officer. They headed to the quote unquote black shoe fleet instead. So they would complete the program, but they wouldn't go on to naval, to the actual, naval academy to be a full-on pilot. They would just get that, I guess, that title of officer and then go do something else. So it's interesting. You know, it kind of goes back to when we talked about Top Gun, how the Navy didn't really want, you know, to be referenced in Top Gun either, but it was only because one person that got a hold of the script saw it as a good recruiting tool and persuaded him to do so. And there's a lot of the different research I saw, they were really kind of tying this movie and Top Gun together, how Top Gun probably would not have been made if this had not been a success, because there were certain parallels in the, you know, military and love story kind of blending those two things together.
And imagine that, because there could not have been a better recruiting tool for that than Top Gun. And like you said, Top Gun gets made because of this. I mean, How many young men wanted to be naval aviators because of Top Gun?
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's funny because I never, like, watching it again, thinking of him becoming an officer, I knew it was the Navy, but I didn't remember it being anything about naval aviation, because you don't ever see any jets. There's no flying. Nobody's flying anything in this movie. Such different than Top Gun. Top Gun gets that appeal because you see them in the fighter jets. You see them, you know, doing the actual flying and learning that. Where in this, it's all, you know, it's more like the basic training that they're doing before they even get to that aspect of the school. So,
right. Well, you also see the difference in budgets there.
Yeah, very true. Very true. Yeah. Very true. Yeah. The Navy's not going to let you get on their base. They're definitely not going to let you use any of their planes.
Absolutely.
And now these messages.
Hello, 80s flick lovers. I just want to take a minute and say thanks again for listening to the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. I hope you're enjoying this episode so far. Sadly, we don't have any shout outs to new buymeacoffee.com members this week, but I want to encourage you, if you haven't already, to support the podcast on a monthly basis through buymeacoffee.com. We have three tiers of support to choose from. You can be a cult classic member, which is only $5 a month, a Be Kind Please Rewind member, which is $10 a month, or you can go big by choosing to be a box office blockbuster member for $15 a month and receive an official 80s Flick Flashback t-shirt. All members on any tier will receive a free logo sticker, so don't miss out. You can also leave a one-time donation for $5 or more if you choose. Just go to our website, 80sflickflashback.com, or the link in the show notes for more details and to start your subscription membership today. We will always offer free episodes, and I will never put any of our past seasons or episodes behind a paywall. But it does cost money to keep the podcast running. Since the creation of the podcast, I've personally paid monthly for the website, the Zoom account, various movie rentals and streaming subscriptions, marketing tools, and other miscellaneous expenses that pop up from time to time. If you love the show, then please consider being one of our subscription members through Buy Me a Coffee. Every little bit helps and will be greatly appreciated. You can also support the show by buying an official logo t-shirt, sweatshirt, or sticker from our online store. There are multiple styles and colors to choose from, so go check out the selection on our website, as well as the link in the show notes. If you've been listening for a while, you know I've been moving away from buying digital movies and going back to buying Blu-rays and DVDs of my favorite movies. If you'd like to help, you can find my Amazon wish list at the link in our show notes. There are movies there priced from $5 to $40, so feel free to purchase one or more. I'll even give you a special thank you on TikTok and Instagram when the movies arrive. Hey, if you love 80s pop music and movie soundtracks as much as I do, you can also find the 80s Flick Flashback Movie Songs Mix playlist on Apple Music. It's full of hit songs like Eye of the Tiger, Flashdance, What a Feeling, and Danger Zone, as well as deeper cuts from the 80s flicks like Lost in the Shadows from The Lost Boys, Only the Young from Vision Quest, and Cool Rider from Grease 2. This would have been my ultimate movie soundtrack mixtape growing up if I could have found a cassette to hold 8 hours worth of songs. So it's perfect for listening to on a fun road trip
or if you're just stuck in a cubicle at work. Thanks again for listening. I really do appreciate every one of you, and I'm amazed each week to watch the number of new listeners grow. It's because of you and your support that the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast is still going strong. Let's keep the fun going. Now, let's get back to today's show. All right, well, let's talk about casting. So, of course, Richard Gere as aviation officer candidate Zach Mayo. Mayonnaise. you knew that was gonna be his nickname as soon as they said his last name.
Oh, absolutely. As soon as he said Mayo, I mean, what else could it be?
Come on, Miracle Whip. He began in films in the 1970s, playing a supporting role on Looking for Mr. Goodbar in 1977 and a starring role in Days of Heaven in 78. He came to prominence with his role in the film American Gigolo in 1980, which established him as a leading man and a sex symbol. He has starred in many films, including The Cotton Club in 84, Pretty Woman in 1990, Summersby in 93, Primal Fear in 96, and of course, Runaway Bride in 1999, and many more that we didn't list. Amazingly enough, originally country music singer and occasional actor John Denver was actually signed on to play Zach Mayo. I cannot see that for anything.
That would have been this. We would not even remember this movie had that. I mean, what did John Denver do? Was it Oh God?
Yeah. Oh God, you devil. Yeah.
Take him from that performance and put him an officer and a gentleman. Oh, yeah. Would have been such a bad decision. I know you're probably going to get to a John Travolta.
Yeah.
Turn the role down as well. But yeah. John Denver would have just been a disaster.
I just can't picture that. It was more of a comedic actor, really more so.
Right.
I just don't see him as that strong, dramatic character in this.
No. And especially playing the darkness mm-hmm. that Mayo plays. I mean, that character, like I said, we see his mother die when he's mm-hmm. a little kid. He goes to stay with the father who doesn't know how to parent and brings him up and raises him, you know, drinking, smoking, mm-hmm. sex, whatever. With women. that's what you do as a man.
Right.
And he doesn't know how to love anybody else. He doesn't know how to think about anybody other than himself, mm-hmm. which is, you know, the movie is, you know, him turning and learning and to become better. And he says, you know, the big scene with Louis Gossett Jr., of course, I've changed and, mm-hmm. and all of that. And realizing that he doesn't have any place else to go. The famous quote that you said earlier. I mean, that's a lot to carry mm-hmm. because it's that darkness, that emotionless at the beginning and nothing matters. I don't care. Right. And then you see little kinks in the heart mm-hmm. and he starts to feel something a little bit for the woman. And then the complete meltdown. And then also the anger and fear when he later fights.
Gunnery Sergeant.
And then of course, sweeping her off her feet, Deborah Winger at the end. I mean, that's a lot of emotions going up and down, and there is no way Take Me Home Country Roads is pulling that off. I'm sorry.
Look,
he's not bad, but he's acting opposite like Kermit the Frog.
Right. And the Muppets Christmas. Yeah.
But there's no way that would have worked.
Yeah. I will say this. If he was able to pull it off, give him all the awards, because that would have been the performance of a lifetime. Yeah.
Yeah. Give him best actor, best supporting actor, best actress, best score. Give it all to John Denver. Yeah,
right. So, yeah, as you mentioned, there were other people that were in the casting process as well. Jeff Bridges, Harry Hamlin, Christopher Reeve, John Travolta. Of course, Gere eventually beat all the other actors for the part. Travolta had turned down the role, as he did with American Gigolo, which also was a Richard Gere box office hit. But, yeah.
Oh, so Gere got both of those roles when Travolta turned yep. down. Interesting.
Yep. So there were a few that they said it was because of their agents, like their agents didn't want them to take the movie, which once again shows that they didn't have a whole lot of faith in it being successful, which I think is kind of disappointing, but it floated around. Well, it wasn't, you know, it
was that's what I was going to say. You said it floated around for 8 years. So yeah. There probably wasn't a lot of belief in it.
Yeah. I want to apologize right now because I wanted to talk about the director, Taylor Hackford, and I forgot to even put him in my notes. He's such a good, he's a great director. And I wanted to mention some of his other movies because this was not his first movie either.
Ray. He did Ray.
Yeah, he did Ray. That was the movie that I remember him being part of. So this was his first major movie that he did.
He's married to Helen Mirren.
Yep. Has been for a long time, I think.
He did White Knight.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, moving on to Deborah Winger as Paula. Winger's first acting role was as Debbie in the 1976 sexploitation film Slumber Party 57. Her next role was as Diana Prince's younger sister, Drusilla Wonder Girl, in three episodes of ABC's TV series Wonder Woman, which I remember when we went back and started watching that on HBO Max when it first came out, seeing her in those first episodes, like, oh my gosh, that's Deborah Winger. The producers wanted her to appear more often on Wonder Woman, but she refused, fearing that the role would hurt her fledgling career. This was followed by a guest role in season four of the TV drama Police Woman in 78. Her first major role was in Thank God It's Friday, followed by Urban Cowboy in 1980 with John Travolta, which she received a BAFTA nomination and a pair of Golden Globe nominations. In 82, she co-starred with Nick Nolte in Canary Row and with Richard Gere in An Officer and a Gentleman, for which she was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Actress. She was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Actress twice more for Terms of Endearment, 83, which was actually awarded to her co-star Shirley MacLaine, who played her mother in the film, and again for Shadowlands in 1993, for which she also received her second BAFTA nomination. So she's a great actress. The role of Paula was originally given to Sigourney Weaver, then to Angelica Houston, and later to Jennifer Jason Leigh, who dropped out in order to do the film Fast Times at Ridgemont High instead. Eventually, Deborah Winger replaced Leigh for the role. Rebecca De Mornay, Meg Ryan, and Gina Davis are also rumored to have auditioned for the role of Paula as well. In spite of the strong on-screen chemistry between Gere and Winger, the actors did not get along during filming. Publicly, she called him a quote-unquote brick wall, while he admitted there was tension between them. 30 years later, Gere was complimentary towards Winger when he said that she was much more open to the camera than he was, and he appreciated the fact that she presented him with an award at the Rome Film Festival much later in life. But it's no surprise, over the years, Winger has acquired a reputation for being outspoken and difficult to work with. She expressed her dislike of An Officer and a Gentleman, for which she refused to do any publicity, and several of her other films, and has been dismissive of some of her co-stars and directors. She was actually set to play Peggy Sue in the film Peggy Sue Got Married, but was forced to back out just before production began after injuring her back in a bicycle accident. The role went to Kathleen Turner. The injury affected Winger's ability to work for several months. She was also cast in A League of Their Own, but dropped out and was replaced by Gina Davis. It was later reported that Winger dropped out of the film because she refused to work with Madonna, whom Winger did not consider a quote-unquote serious actress. Other starring roles during this period included Legal Eagles, Made in Heaven, Everybody Wins, Leap of Faith, Black Widow, Betrayed, and A Dangerous Woman. So she stayed working, but yeah, I remember the stories of her not being difficult to work with on film, but it doesn't show. Once again, shows professional actors that you don't see that on the screen, which is good.
If I could replace her, I would. I would love to see Sigourney Weaver in that role. Jennifer Jason Leigh, I mean, she would have had to be like 19 or something.
Yeah,
that would have been a
little
big
weird.
Age gap. Angelica Houston is always hard to me because she's always the mom from the Addams Family. Every time I ever think of her, anything, yeah. That's just what she said. It's hard for me to picture her.
Right.
But I mean, that's a pretty Sigourney Weaver would be the right age range for that.
Yeah.
And I never cared for Deborah Winger's performance in this movie, really.
Yeah.
And when she says Richard Gere is, you know, the criticism was that, like you said, he wasn't giving her anything to work with, that he was, you know, kind of a cold performance. But that's
his character. Role. Yeah, that was his character. Yeah.
Right. So, I think her performance is pretty cold and emotionless.
Yeah. If I have a criticism with the movie, is I don't understand how they were so serious so quick. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's not much of an establishment of the relationship that I can see. I mean, it just seems very, you know, we kind of knew what they were. You knew what the girls were intended to do at the beginning. So they're already not painted in a very good light. We kind of know where he is, that I see it more in the second half of the movie than I did at the beginning. And it made it a little harder for me to kind of root for them early on in the movie.
Yeah, they really don't have, because like you see them together and they're talking, and then you see them the next morning.
Right.
Like, so you miss the whatever in-depth conversation or connection seem to be had, that they just didn't have the connection. But yeah, you're that's a good point.
But I agree with you. I think Sigourney Weaver would have been a good choice. I think Rebecca Dorman, I guess, you know, we just did
Rebecca Dorman would have been
Runaway Train on my last episode, and seeing her portrayal on that, she would have been really good in this, I think. Meg Ryan, maybe, but yeah.
Take me to bed or lose me forever. It's just, I could hear her yelling at Richard Gere in this movie.
Right.
Top Gun, obviously. But
yeah.
I agree. Rebecca De Mornay, I think, would have been fabulous as well.
Yeah. The next actor we have is David Keith as Sid Worley. And I'll tell you what, I was really impressed with him in this movie. Like, I don't, you know, I forgot that he was in this, but I thought he was phenomenal in this movie.
You've seen him in other things, and then when you see him in this, you realize what a good actor he is or could be.
Right.
In other things you see him in, he's not giving that same level of performance. But yeah, absolutely, he's fantastic in this.
Yeah. So this was his breakthrough role, and he was actually nominated for a Golden Globe Award, which was well-earned. The positive reception for this role led to leading parts in the films The Lords of Discipline in 83, Firestarter in 84, and White of the Eye in 87. He's had supporting roles and features, including Major League 2 in 94, The Indian in the Cupboard in 95, U-571 in 2000, Men of Honor in 2000, and Daredevil in 2003. So he has worked for a long time. He's kind of been one of those kind of hit or miss kind of actors for sure. We talk about the relationship between Mayo and Paula. Yeah. But I think his friendship with Sid also was a big part of him kind of learning to care for other people too. I mean, that was that friendship was kind of, you know, in those kind of situations, you go through that kind of a life altering experience of training. Like, say, the best relationships are born in the trenches when people go through things together. Those strong bonds are made. So I thought the movie did a good job of showing the development of their friendship as well in the movie too. So.
Because there's four of them in that room.
Yeah.
But it's the two of them that form the tight relationship bond.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, when he catches Gear, when he finds out that he's getting the shine boots and the belt buckles from somebody else and basically blackmails him to help him with the, get better at training. And
but that would just draw the respect.
Exactly.
Richard Gere character. Cause he's conning and getting by. Now you're conning and getting by on him. So that would just add to it. But yeah, that's a good point, Tim.
Yeah. And then of course, Robert Loggia as his dad, Byron Mayo, which I didn't realize he was in this movie either until when he first showed up. I was like, you know, that voice is instantly distinguishable. So, in a career spanning over 60 years, Loggia performed in many films, including The Greatest Story Ever Told in 65. He was in three of the Pink Panther movies. He was in Scarface in 82, Pritzi's Honor in 85, Over the Top in 87, Necessary Roughness in 91, and of course, Independence Day in 1996.
That's what I know him best from. When I think of him, I think of the role in Independence Day.
Yeah, yeah, the general. In the original script, Mayo's dad visited Mayo during training and had a much bigger role. At the graduation ceremony, when Zach says he's going to get his first salute, he was actually referring to his father. A scene was shot at the graduation where Zach's father salutes him. This goes back to a point in the beginning when Zach's dad said he'd never salute him. Robert Loggia protested that being cut out of the movie, but the footage is considered lost, which I thought was kind of a shame because I thought it would have been a good scene.
That's fantastic. I did not know that was missing. That would have been, wow, how does that get cut?
Right. And I think that would have been good to see him. You know, he's such a pivotal part at that, like I said, those first like 5 or 10 minutes of the movie, but then you never see him again for the rest of the movie. I would have thought that would have been a good way to bring him back into the story.
And provides a little bit of redemption for his character.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you never salute me, and then showing up and saluting him. So,
yeah,
man. Sometimes what gets left on the floor, is surprising.
Well, as you and I have discussed recently with the length of movies that came out, you know, just the last 2 months of 3 hour running times and 2.5 hour running times. Oh, this one was right at 2 hours and 7 minutes, I think. So it had to get cut, you know, and there's not a whole lot that I would say was unnecessary. Like, I think it's a pretty well paced and well made movie.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's definitely well paced, but like you said, it's the 2 hour range.
Yeah.
And that's what movies used to be between 150 and 210. That was all your movies.
Yeah.
And now these 3 hour behemoths are just breaking me down.
All right. So then we got Lisa Albacker. I recognized that name when it showed up in the credits as Cadet Casey Seeger. She started acting as a child, appearing in such shows as My Three Sons and Gunsmoke. She later made a transition to adult roles in such shows as The Amazing Spider-Man. She's best known for her two roles in the 80s. This one, Officer and Gentleman, and Beverly Hills Cop. She was Jenny Summers, the childhood friend of Eddie Murphy's character in Beverly Hills Cop, which is why I recognize the name.
Wow.
You didn't get the connection.
I did not realize that. No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. The funny thing, she was actually an amateur bodybuilder. So she said the hardest part of her role in An Officer and Gentleman was pretending to be out of shape.
And she couldn't get over the wall.
Yeah.
And also a scene of her struggling to do a pull-up.
Remember
when she stays back on leave?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's a bodybuilder. Yeah. She's cranking out pull-ups with no problem.
she was doing the push-ups with them at the beginning. And she was struggling. So, yeah.
She's probably doing better than them.
Yeah, exactly. All right, and then we got, of course, Louis Gossett Jr. as Gunnery Sergeant Emil Foley, USMC. He is one of the most respected and beloved actors on stage, screen, and television. He's also an accomplished writer, producer, and director. He was the first African-American to win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for An Officer and a Gentleman. Among his other awards are Emmy for Outstanding Lead Actor as his portrayal of Fiddler in the groundbreaking ABC series Roots. He got a Golden Globe for Best Performance by an Actor in a Supporting Role for The Josephine Baker Story, and a Golden Globe as well for An Officer and a Gentleman. His film debut was in the 1961 classic film A Raisin in the Sun with Sidney Poitier. Other film credits include The Deep, Blue Chips, Daddy's Little Girls, Firewalker, Jaws 3D, Enemy Mine, and Iron Eagle 1-4.
The win for him, you know, for Best Supporting Actor, I believe it was the third for a Black actor or actress in the category, but it was also notable because it was a position of power
right.
for a Black actor of being in right. charge of white actors instead mm-hmm. of you know, some kind of maid or subservient or
right.
or slave
right. slave
role.
Right exactly
but here's a role, and I know that he had noted that he was very proud of that mm-hmm. fact,
yes,
that it was just that he's in charge of, mm-hmm. of this thing, and he happened to be Black. And so winning the Best Supporting Actor for that, I know he mentioned that in his statement, and mm-hmm. it was notable definitely at the time in the early 80s.
Yeah. He said that he actually, after he was proud of winning and he was proud of the movie, but he was very, afraid is not a good word. He was concerned about racist, you know, retaliation. He said, you know, to see him whip Kunta Kinte and Roots didn't really upset anybody, but to see him basically kick Richard Gere's butt in that fight scene at the beginning, I mean, towards the end, he was like,
wasn't his butt that he kicked.
Yeah. So he's like, you know, he said he doesn't go to a lot of bars because there's always some Yahoo that's going to say all that Hollywood stuff is fake. I'm going to show you how, you know, real man fights or whatever. And
wise decision on his part, probably. Right. There's a lot of idiots out there in the world.
Exactly. Don't be one of those idiots. All right. So casting the role of Gunnery Sergeant was very difficult. First, none of the A-list actors approached for the part, including Jack Nicholson, were interested. Second, Mandy Patinkin gave an audition that the producers loved, but the director nixed their plans to cast Patinkin because he felt the actor was quote unquote too ethnic to play a drill sergeant. He was going to regret that later on. You'll see here in a second. R. Lee Ermey was also considered for Gunnery Sergeant Emil Foley due to his time of being an actual drill sergeant. I'm sorry, actual drill instructor for the United States Marine Corps in the 1960s. Of course, he's most famous for his role as the drill sergeant in Full Metal Jacket.
Full Metal.
Yeah, if you don't recognize that name. So the producers actually did research in Pensacola, Florida, and learned that all of the top drill instructors there were African Americans. So Taylor Hackford cast Louis Gossett Jr. and had Ermy coach him for the role as the film's technical advisor. Hackford kept Gossett Jr. in separate living quarters from the other actors during production so Gossett could intimidate them more during his scenes as drill instructor. In addition to R. Lee Ermy, Gossett was advised by Gunnery Sergeant Buck Welsher, an actual drill sergeant at Aviation Officer Candidate School in Pensacola. He can actually be seen leading the senior class after the run.
You know, one of the best things about the movie, and again, I remember this as a kid, because at the beginning when Louis Gossett Jr. is giving them such a hard time on the first day meeting them, and he's berating them and belittling them, and you're like, and you're like, what's all that about? And then you see them go through the entire process, and then that new class comes in at the end, and you see him doing it all over again, and you're like, that's just the job. That's what you have to do to break these people down,
right?
And get them through this. I love that the movie. Because think about how easy it is to not show that little clip at the end again.
Exactly. Doing that, exactly.
And you miss that entire component of it's not personal to that gunnery sergeant. This is his job and what he's doing. Right. He does it to everybody.
Yep. It's funny because my dad was actually a drill sergeant for a small part of his military career. Somebody did like I call it a painting, but it was like different aspects of military life. And they used my dad as a drill sergeant in one of the spots. So he has it hanging up in his office. So
Cool.
I always think about this. And I think about Full Metal Jacket because when Full Metal Jacket came out on VHS, I remember we didn't own it, but I think we rented it. And my dad took a little tape, and I'll probably talk about this when we ever do Full Metal Jacket. But my dad took a little tape recorder and he would record parts of the drill sergeant, like yelling and berating, whatever. And in his office, he said, if the office got too quiet during the day, he would just hit play and let it play through the office to kind of get people like liven up the office or whatever. So I remember being in his office sometimes and him doing that. So it was his kind of, you know, his kind of some of his glory days. I remember being able to like verbally beat people into submission.
that is classic. Shout out to Mr. Williams.
For
doing that.
All right. So last person in the cast I'll mention just briefly. And of course I didn't realize he was in this movie either, but young David Caruso as Topper Daniels, who was the first to DOR of the group. Of course, after almost drowning in the exercise, being choked by the gunnery sergeant, he wasn't going to last very long. So,
but yeah, you should have known he had breathing problems when he got choked by the gunnery sergeant there before he went into the water tank.
Yep. So,
he wasn't around.
Yeah, just a small role, but it's funny to think about. He had a small role in First Blood, which he did last year, and then he popped up in this one. So, just wanted to throw his name out there. So, but a great cast. I think overall it was good. I think we both agree Deborah Winger may not have been the best female lead, but she still did all right. I mean, she garnered some nominations, so she wasn't terrible, just not our favorite.
Not our cup of tea, but yeah, the movie is really just perfectly cast, including the supporting characters. Outstanding. And when it all comes together like that, just a beautiful thing to watch.
And now these messages.
What seems to be the problem, pal?
There's just so much pain in the world, so many issues. I don't think I can bear it.
Well, friendo, it sounds like you could use a dose of Pop Culture Roulette.
Pop Culture Roulette? What's that? Some sort of pop culture themed podcast or something?
That's right, sonny boy. When hope seems far, dive into some PCR.
But I already get my entertainment news from Variety.
Huh, that's pretty good. If you're a chucklehead, PCR gives you news you need, condensed, unfiltered, and raw, from three nerds who know a little something about something.
Wow, okay, sign me up.
That's the spirit. Pop Culture Roulette. New episodes every Monday, available on all major podcast directories.
Now playing on a cell phone near you. A show for all the manly men out there, where guys talk about their favorite movies and what they can teach us about being a man. Featuring the coolest guests.
Murder somebody is not like killing an ant.
The most gratifying laughs.
It's Tombstone, what can I say?
And a fresh take on movies like you've never heard before.
this will be the thing that gets written on his proverbial tombstone.
We aren't here to criticize the movies you love, but to praise them for how they apply to our lives as husbands, fathers, and really all men in general. So buckle up your seatbelts, because Manly Movies is here. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or your other favorite podcast catcher. And remember, man up.
Comic books have been around for almost a century, and in the last two decades, we've finally gotten to see many of these characters brought to life in movies and on TV. On the Moving Panels podcast, we discuss movies and TV shows based on, inspired by, and adapted from the world of comic books. Join me and my guests as we discuss both the good and the bad from Marvel, DC, and even some of the lesser-known comic book companies. Learn what is and isn't from the comics, as well as our nerdy review of the movie or show. New episodes drop every Monday, and you can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. So join us for Moving Panels, and I'll see you on the other side of the page.
All right, well, let's talk about iconic scenes, favorite scenes. I guess we both know the most iconic scene is definitely the ending. I mean, that's what most people think of when they think of this movie. Any other scene jump out at you?
Well, you referenced the one earlier. I know myself.
Right.
When the gunnery sergeant is attempting to make Mayo DOR, trying to make him quit. And then he says, "I won't quit." And to give the point of reference to those listening who may not know, and it's he finally has to admit and break down and start crying and say, "I can't quit because this is all I have. This is my only shot. There's nothing else I can do." But the other, for me, always, I won't say it makes me cry, but probably get a little wet around the eyes, is when Mayo, who is all about himself, and the movie shows him that way from the very beginning, and he's out to set the course record, his name in the history books there, and instead he goes back to help, what's her name in the movie again?
Casey Seeger.
Seeger goes back to help Seeger, who cannot get over the wall. This is, they said you only got three tries to get over the wall. This is going to be her third try. She doesn't get over, then she's out.
Right.
And he gives up the record to go back and walk her through the steps to get her over the wall and then finish the course together. Mm-hmm. And you see the full circle of, I care about someone else more than I care about me. Mm-hmm. I care about helping someone. And that scene is always a really touching moment for me. What about you?
Yeah, well, I just want to mention that scene as well, because I knew where you were going when you started into it. But what I love about that scene, too, is that the class rallies behind him, rallying behind her, which once again shows he was a leader, that's what they were trying to develop into. I think the gunnery sergeant saw he could be a leader because he knew that, people looked up to him and wanted, getting close to setting that record, that was helping the class, try to achieve better. So I love that scene of them all cheering them both on and being just as excited as she was that she made it over the wall. So, which I thought was great.
The other, before I forget,
no, go ahead.
The very end, which I looked it up because they never explained it. So when they're going to get that suit, get the pin from the gunnery sergeant who's giving them the new title, and then they give them, is it a silver dollar? And when you see the emotional connection that they have now formed between Mayo and again, where the gunnery sergeant is tearing up as Mayo tells him, "I will never forget you."
Right.
And while he's proud of all of these different classes and things, but that's different. He saw this man change who he is.
Yeah.
And that there's real emotion there. That's also a very, I think, important scene in that movie.
Mm-hmm. I read this. It's a tradition for the drill instructor to place the silver dollar of his memorable students in his right pocket. You can see that Mayo's dollar is placed in Foley's right pocket rather than the left pocket, as it is for some of the other cadets that came up to him beforehand. So I thought I saw that about the silver dollar, which I thought was, I was kind of thinking the same thing during that scene, like what this obviously has some significance, but didn't really know what it was until I looked it up. So that was
right. They don't explain what's happening. They just all line up to see him.
I mean, I think you covered most of the scenes that I thought were really good. Of course, not favorite scenes, but just powerful scenes. I think the interesting thing about this movie is in most movies, I guess like that, there's so much to be set up in the first half, but the second half of the movie, it's compiled with multiple situations that they have to overcome. So of course, with the girls and the relationship of whether he's going to stay or not, and then with Sid and his relationship with the girl, and you know, her telling him she's pregnant and him trying to decide what he's going to do, and then that whole situation, which was intense. And then of course them finding him in the hotel was I didn't remember that in the movie at all until it came. I was like, no, he's going to catch him in time. It's not going to be that way. And then it wasn't. And so that just adds so much more of the drama at the end.
I remember being very uneasy about that scene as a 10-year-old watching that movie.
Yeah.
This guy hangs himself in the shower and commits suicide. Mm-hmm. But you know, I also saw Halloween when I was 5 in the movie theater. So I've seen some things, but that, I remember that just a real uneasy feeling about what did I just see? I don't really understand what it was.
But I will say one scene that is one of my favorites. And I think it's just because it's the line that keeps being repeated. But when Mayo has to stay behind and has to do after he gets busted for, you know, all the contraband in he had over his bed. And so he's got to, you know, gunnery starts his one-on-one training and in the rain and the mud or whatever. But my favorite thing from Gunnery is, don't be eyeballing me, boy. You eyeballing me? Every time Gear would look at him, don't be eyeballing me, boy. And I just, and that cracked me up every time he would say it. But I was that was good. But that's part of the training, because he's teaching him, don't react. I'm going to berate you, but you've got to stay level headed and calm in this situation. Mm-hmm. Stay focused on what you're doing. And so every time you eyeballing me. And so I just thought that was hilarious, but it's necessary. But that was a scene. And even some of the songs they sang, which I thought were pretty funny,
which we would not repeat here.
No. Which I did read that they, you know, of course, you know, you have the R-rated version and the TV version. And they said, you know, most of the TV version, they cut a lot of the stuff out, but they said two scenes were specifically shot for a TV version and the film version. And one of those was that one-on-one training. So they obviously sang something very different on the TV version. And also the suicide scene, they altered that somewhat where it wasn't as shocking. And I think because it also didn't have him butt naked hanging as well. So for good reason. But yeah, but I just thought that was, I was thinking about that as I was watching. I was like, how did they edit this for television? This song right here. All right. Any other scenes you want to talk about? Or we'll jump into trivia and maybe something else will pop up as we go.
No, I'm good. Let's jump.
All right. So, this, of course, was part of a mini cycle of Hollywood movies made during the early 80s centered around military cadet training. Other movies included Taps in 81, Stripes in 81, Private Benjamin in 80, The Lords of Discipline in 83. In the mid to late 80s, you saw a few more like Biloxi Blues in 88, Top Gun in 86, Heartbreak Ridge in 86, and as we mentioned, Full Metal Jacket in 87. Lots of military movies in the 80s for sure.
Yeah, Biloxi Blues is really good.
Yeah, yeah. That's one I keep saying I need to go back and watch, but I haven't seen it on one of the streaming services recently. That's one that I watched a lot as a kid. That was one of my favorites.
Yeah. Well, it's Ferris Bueller.
Yeah.
Ferris Bueller in the military.
Yeah. And that was actually the play he was doing. Him and Alan Ruck were doing that play on Broadway when they got cast for Ferris Bueller.
Ferris Bueller.
All right. And then, so this was, I'm talking about Taylor Hackford, the director. This is one of three early to mid 80s movies directed by Taylor Hackford with a hit song associated with the movie. In White Nights in 1985, the songs were Say You, Say Me, written and performed by Lionel Richie, and Separate Lives, written by Stephen Bishop and performed by Phil Collins and Marilyn Martin. And Against All Odds in 84, the song was Against All Odds, Take a Look at Me Now, sung by Phil Collins. And An Officer and Gentleman, the song was Up Where We Belong, sung by Joe Cocker. Who was the duet with? I don't have it listed. Was that?
Man, I can't remember. I did see it, but I don't remember.
Yeah. I apologize. I thought it was on there.
Jennifer Warnes.
Okay. So Up Where We Belong, sung by Joe Cocker and Jennifer Warnes. All of these themes were Oscar nominated for the Best Original Song Academy Award. The ones performed by Collins did not win, but the Richie and Cocker songs did take home the gold statuette. Producer Don Simpson unsuccessfully demanded the ballad Up Where We Belong be cut from the film, saying, quote unquote, the song is no good. It isn't a hit. The song later became the number one song on the Billboard chart and won the Academy Award. He wanted a similar song called On the Wings of Love by Jeffrey Osborne. The song was released a few months later, and it peaked at number 29 on the Billboard charts. So,
yeah, but that's a great song.
That's a great song, too. Yeah.
On the Wings of Love.
Yeah. I will say this for just for a shameless plug, that all three of those songs that we mentioned besides On the Wings of Love are on the 80s Flick Flashback movie mix playlist on Apple Music. So if you want to go and listen to them, you can hear them in all their glory. Though not stated, Gunnery Sergeant Emil Foley is a Vietnam War veteran, which is shown by his medal ribbons, which included the Vietnam Service Medal with three campaign stars. Thought that was interesting that, once again, wasn't really explained in the movie, but was there. I thought you might like this. The Are You Calling Me a U lecture, U-E-W-E lecture, that Louis Gossett Jr. gives to David Keith was used a decade earlier, except for the cursing and sexual references, on the series Gomer Pyle USMC.
You calling me a U? That's a female sheep. You calling me a sheep?
I need to find some episodes of Gomer Pyle. I remember that show so fondly as a kid.
I actually watched some last year because, you know, Andy Griffith showed for me is the greatest show in the history of television.
Yeah.
And Gomer Pyle holds up pretty well.
So the film, in fact, progresses very quickly through the officer candidate school training, although this would be unfamiliar to most audiences unless they're familiar with how OCS operates. The training progresses through three phases: indoctrination, academic, and then leadership. The indoctrination is seen at the beginning when the candidates meet Foley, but only a few scenes later, the students are shown taking advanced aerodynamic classes, which in reality would have been weeks later in academic training. About a half an hour later in the film, after Zach has demonstrated he wants to stay in OCS by enduring Foley's abuse, the students are wearing railroad tracks on their collars, indicating they're in the leadership stage, which occurs at the 10th or 11th week, which is less than 2 to 3 weeks from graduation. This also explains why Sid dropping out at such a late stage came as such a shock to Lynette.
Such a bad decision, Sid.
Yeah. But yeah, they never really explained that it was a 13-week training. So it does kind of seem like their hair does grow back. I mean, they're, you know, they, of course, they all have their long hair at the beginning. Then it's cut really short in that first. So even when they're at the, I think that they're at the dance, to me, I feel like that had to have been several weeks later because their hair had kind of grown out a little bit more. So
Right. And one of them says, in fact, it grew back.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. But you're right. They never explained really the timeline.
Yeah. But also gives a little bit more, like we talked about with the blooming of the relationships, that it didn't just happen in like a 2 or 3 week course. That's, you know, 13 weeks. That's 3 months, basically, fairly long time to build some good relationships. So.
Absolutely.
All right, last little bit. Richard Gere balked at shooting the ending of the film in which Zach arrives at Paula's factory wearing his naval dress whites and carries her off the factory floor. Gere thought the ending would not work because it was too sentimental. Taylor Hackford agreed with Gere until, during a rehearsal, the extras playing the workers began to cheer and cry at the same time. When Gere saw the scene later with the music underneath it at the right tempo, he said it gave him chills. Gere was now convinced Hackford made the right decision. Screenwriter David Hogg, in his book Writing Screenplays That Sell, echoed this opinion. He said, "I don't believe those that criticize the Cinderella-style ending were paying very close attention to who exactly is rescuing whom," which I thought was a cool little.
Oh, that's a great line.
Great line.
Yeah, that is great. But that is such an iconic scene, and the way it's shot. You know, and those plants, everything is gray.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the equipment's gray, all the walls are gray, the floor is gray, the people are gray, and just that flash of white just walking in between the grays, just stopping. Even when it gets to her mother, just like, hey, where is she? Just
right.
A quick look at her, and then just keeps going. I've got a goal. There's someplace I'm going.
Yeah,
that woman is over there, and I'm going to get and just straight to her.
Mm-hmm.
It is just a beautiful shot.
Yeah.
But I mean, there is a point there. Take the movie, the music out of that scene and picture it. It doesn't really
different.
Play. Yeah. It doesn't play. But with the music.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's like the friend. Go Paula.
Right. Yay, right. Paula. Right. Yeah. Go back to the mother. I think what got me in the ending scene was watching the mom's reaction. Because it takes it back to that scene where the mom stopping her from going after Mayo, looking for him on the base. She's like, don't do it. You're going to regret it. you know, you're going to try to trap him. And then, you know, you trapping him is not going to be the same as him wanting him, really wanting you. So for him to show up there, it was like telling the mom, look, this is, he's a real man. He isn't just, you know, this isn't just out of guilt or some game that they were playing. It was, it made it a little bit more real, which I thought was really good. So.
And the mom, as soon as I saw the mom, I realized I had never seen her in anything else. She's from Seinfeld. She's George Costanza's almost mother-in-law. Yeah. That the fiance dies, but then he's still involved with the mother-in-law.
Oh, right. Right.
From the foundation. And she drinks a lot of alcohol and stuff. As soon as I saw her, I was like, oh, wow. Okay. That's the mom and officer and a gentleman.
Very good. Very good. All right. Any other scenes you want to talk about or anything else? I think we covered it pretty well.
No other scenes, man. Sometimes you watch one of these movies that we kind of grew up with and you're like, you know, it doesn't hold up. Man, it's a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a great movie. Anyone out there that maybe listen that has not seen this or have not really watched it in its entirety in a while, watch the actual unedited version. You got to get through all the profanity and some inappropriateness of especially with modern day. But man, it's such a great movie.
Yeah.
Great
movie. All right, let's talk about box office and critical reception. So An Officer and a Gentleman had a limited release on July 30th, 1982, where it finished third at the box office behind The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas at number two with Dolly Parton and Burt Reynolds.
Burt Reynolds.
And E.T. the Extraterrestrial, which was at number one for its second week. So it's tough to open against E.T. in its second week. It was still an enormous box office success and went on to become the third highest grossing film of 1982 after E.T. the Extraterrestrial and Tootsie with Dustin Hoffman. So didn't do bad. It came in number three.
Yeah, it's not bad at all. I had to laugh on the Dolly Parton, Burt Reynolds, Best Little Whorehouse. I cannot hear the title of that movie and not Texas Has a Whorehouse in It. Lord have mercy, oh my soul. That's the little theme song that plays throughout the entire movie.
But, I have never seen that movie.
I watched it a few years ago. Had not watched it. It does not hold up well. It is not great. When you got Burt Reynolds starring in a musical, it's probably not
right.
You
know. Right. I do remember though when it came on HBO as a kid, my parents watched it. Like they when the living white and me and my sister were not allowed to come and interrupt them while it was on because they were going to watch it. And so, but they were big Dolly Parton fans and Burt Reynolds fans. So, but it was on, the funny thing is it was on TV, like on Saturday, but it was on IFC or one of those, but I missed like the first 30. Same. I missed like the first 30 minutes. So I didn't watch it. So.
That's gotta be seen as an edited version too. The only thing worthwhile about watching that is it's cause it's a Dom DeLuise and you know, the Dom DeLuise Burt Reynolds pairings are, there's always some fun there.
Pure gold.
You tell those guys are having a lot of fun.
Oh yeah. So Rotten Tomatoes has it at 78% on the tomato meter and 81% audience score. IMDb has it at 7 out of 10 with viewers and a 75 on Metacritic, which is extremely high for Metacritic for it to be that high.
It's also rare for all four of those to basically be the same.
Yeah, they're pretty close.
I mean, they're all right. Usually one is really, really high or really, really low. Mm-hmm. Man, that's a balanced, but it's also 40 years old, so you got more time to get balanced reviews, I guess.
Right. So, I would put this in the 80s range for me, you know, it's not the greatest movie. I mean, but it's definitely rewatchable. It's one that I'll definitely watch again, have a lot of respect for, and enjoyed watching. So,
yeah, probably around an 85 for me, if we're putting a percentage on something.
Yeah.
But I agree. Definitely one worth watching, especially if it has not been watched in a while.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Well, thanks so much for listening. Thank you, Ron, for joining. We're going to bring this one to a close, but be sure to follow, subscribe, rate, and review the podcast if you haven't already. Support the show through buymeacoffee.com. You can buy a t-shirt or a sweatshirt from our website. Of course, Ron has one of our t-shirts.
I have mine.
Yeah,
sure do. Wear it proudly.
So support the show how you can. We appreciate all the support you can get. If you enjoyed the episode, share it with someone who loves 80s flicks. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok, and all that fun, enjoyable stuff. But always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you for joining me for this episode, and we got more fun stuff.
My pleasure. I love you, brother.
I too appreciate it. All right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Good night, good people.
Peace.
What's up, dudes? I'm Jerry D of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, books, fashion, and fads.
If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, he's got it covered. Wait, is there a lot of things to talk about for the 80s and Christmas?
Well, you got the movie giants like Christmas Vacation, Scrooged, and A Christmas Story. There are TV specials like Muppet Family Christmas, Claymation Christmas Celebration, and a Garfield Christmas special.
Plus classics shown every year.
You also jam out to Last Christmas, Do They Know It's Christmas, and Christmas in Hollis. But most of all, it was a time for the most bodacious, best-selling Christmas toys ever, like He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers,
and Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yes, them too. We cover them all, plus much more, including standard segments like Hap Hap Happiest Memory, Gag Me with the Spoon, The Other Half of the Battle,
and Chant with the Littles.
So tune in to Totally Rad Christmas everywhere you get your podcasts. Turn the clock back and dive into those warm and fuzzy memories.
Later, dudes.
Hey, everybody. Do you ever just sit around with your friends and reminisce about days and how things used to be when you were a kid or a teenager or maybe even a young adult, the TV shows and the movies that you watched at the time, and how things just aren't quite the same today? Well, let me tell you, I've got the place for you. My name is Chris Adams, and I'm the host of the podcast Retro Life for You. And here at Retro Life for You, we talk about and discuss movies and TV that is retro, and we are going back from the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s. Hey, sometimes we might even touch back to the 70s if we're feeling good. If this is for you, make sure you look for us on everywhere that you can find your podcast at. Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Google, Stitcher. We're hosted on Anchor FM. And make sure you follow us on all the major networks and leave us a rating and a review. It really does help. Look forward to hearing from you.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.